From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. In place of a platform at the RNC this week, Republicans put forward just one man, Donald Trump. Executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, Gerald Side, says we shouldn't be surprised by today's Republican Party at all. In fact, we should have seen it coming. That's the title of his new book. Over 40 years, Saib has followed the rise of populism, nationalism, and the cult of personality within the Republican Party. He joins us to take a closer look at how the party got where it is today and where it may be going. This hour on Point, the Republican Party, past and future. With me from Washington this hour, Gerald Saib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal. You can find an excerpt of his new book at our website, onpointradio.org. Jerry, welcome back to On Point. How nice to have you.
Hey, Jane, really nice to be with you. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you. Let's begin this hour about the evolution of the Republican Party by asking you what you heard in the Republican National Convention this week, and specifically from President Trump.
Well, you know, it was interesting because you almost had the sense of a challenger, Donald Trump, taking on an incumbent, Joe Biden, which is unusual because he attempted to essentially blame the Biden forces for unrest in the streets and to say essentially Joe Biden represents the status quo that I'm here to overturn. That's an odd message in many ways for somebody who's been in the White House for 3.5 years. But I think it's completely in keeping with the portrayal of Donald Trump that I, you know, say sort of concluded was most fitting in the book, which is to say he's the ultimate outsider coming in to overtake the conventional conservative Republican Party and all of Washington. And almost 4 years in, that really hasn't changed very much. He still thinks he's the outsider. His people want him to be, his supporters want him to be an outsider. We continue to find that in polling. And that tells you a lot about how he got there in the first place. It was by essentially not buying into any establishment message or to the Republican establishment, but by challenging it and continuing to do so.
You know, this is the first time since 1856 that the Republican Party has not laid out specific policy positions in a party platform, specific policy positions for the next 4 years, other than to say that the party, quote, enthusiastically supports the president's America First agenda. What did you make of the fact that the Republican Party did not present a platform this year? And what does it say to you about the state of the Republican Party?
Well, part of it was logistics. They couldn't figure out how to do a platform in the conventional sense, given that they uprooted their convention from Charlotte and then from Jacksonville and then to basically kind of nowhere and everywhere in between. So there was that element of it. But I also think, though, that there is a reality here, which is that right now, this is Donald Trump's Republican Party. And whether that remains the case is one of the things that's going to be determined on November 3rd. But there's no putting Trumpism back in the bottle right now. And so you really have Donald Trump, who doesn't have so much a governing philosophy, not a conservative governing philosophy that you could really write into a long platform, but kind of more instincts. And his instincts are populist and nationalist. And we know what they are. They basically say free trade agreements negotiated by my own party in many cases have failed. We need a border wall and to stop the immigration tide from the south. The kind of conservative economic hands-off policies of the past don't work for my people, who are more working class and more in need of government help than conservatives have been willing to acknowledge. And I think the America's role in the world has been overplayed, and we're going to get out of these, what he calls and did last night, endless wars. So those are the Trump messages, and you don't need a long platform to understand them. How they play out in specifics depend, in many cases, on the circumstances around them. And, you know, conventional conservatives, including many of the business community, will accept that uncertainty because the two other things you get from the Trump platform, in reality, tax cuts and deregulation of the business sector, and that's enough for them. And religious conservatives are happy that they know they're going to get reliable appointments of conservative judges. And that's pretty much it. And I think that in terms of a platform, that's all kind of well understood.
Well, for almost four decades, you write that the conservative movement was defined by one person, by Ronald Reagan and by the Reagan Revolution, and that Donald Trump turned Republicans away from four decades of Reagan-style conservatism to this new gospel of populism and nationalism, Trumpism, right? It's a shift that's been building for a while, and I'd like you to help us understand that. How did that happen? How did that shift happen?
Well, the main point of the book really is that Donald Trump didn't just come as a bolt out of the blue, although it may have seemed that way to many people, including many people in my business, but that in fact there were signs along the road that this movement toward Trumpism, toward populism and nationalism was developing. In fact, the book came about because I, like a lot of people in Washington, a lot of people in my business, were trying to figure out where did this come from? How did this happen? Because of all the people who were running for president in 2016 on the Republican side, and there were 16 or 17 of them, at the outset, Donald Trump may have seemed the least likely, the least plausible of that field to actually win the nomination, much less the election. Yet it happened. And so how did it happen? And how were so many people so surprised? And I guess what I concluded was that if you go back and relive this period, which, you know, I covered, you see many signs that this was building. You know, Pat Buchanan was one. Sarah Palin was one. Mike Huckabee was one. Ross Perot was certainly one. The rise of the Tea Party was one. And those seemed at the time that maybe they were marginal developments, or that they were aberrations, or that they didn't really represent anything long-lasting. But in fact, they were a sign that within the Republican Party and within the nation, there was a kind of a new reality emerging, that significant demographic changes had occurred in the Republican Party. Lots of working class, middle class voters who used to be Democrats have moved into the party over time for cultural reasons. They didn't like gay marriage, didn't like transgender rights, were very opposed to abortion, didn't like the East Coast elitist attitude of some Democrats, and they became Republicans. And they got to the Republican Party for cultural and attitudinal reasons and decided that the kind of the economic globalization, free trade embrace of the conservative movement, plus a lot of immigration, didn't really fit with their view of the world. And Donald Trump understood all of that. And in many ways, he recognized there was an open door there for somebody like him, and he walked through it.
Well, you write and talk about this, the populist revolution that's been brewing in slow motion for many years. You mentioned Pat Buchanan, Ross Perot, the Tea Party, right at the heart of that. But you say Sarah Palin, with her populist message, was the biggest tip-off that a populist movement, a shift, really, within the Republican Party was afoot in background, in personality, in message. Here is the former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin speaking at the National Tea Party Convention in Nashville in 2010.
The Tea Party movement is not a top-down operation. It's a ground-up call to action that is forcing both parties to change the way that they're doing business, and that's beautiful.
She didn't have the political chops, you say, to carry it forward, but she had her figure on something. And you quote Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's 2016 chief political advisor, as saying to you that Sarah Palin proved that this kind of a populist run was possible, Jerry Seib.
Yeah, and people forget how electric Sarah Palin was at the very beginning of her nomination as the running mate to John McCain in 2008. I mean, she gave the best. I was at that convention, obviously, and she gave the best speech at that convention. And then for 2 weeks or so afterwards, she was lighting up the political world. She was filling auditoriums. She was even filling stadiums. And she had this populist, folksy message that was very unconventional and that was striking chords. And it was only when the limits of her own abilities and knowledge became apparent that she became not an asset and ultimately, I think, for the McCain campaign, a liability. But as Steve Bannon told me, in that moment, there was something there, and it morphed into the Tea Party, and then it morphed into the Trump campaign, I think, in many ways. There's one other element that was at work at the time that I think is worth mentioning here, which is that one of the other factors that came into play over time, over this four-decade arc that we're talking about, was the end of the Cold War, because in many ways, the Cold War and anti-communism was the glue that held together conservatives and Republicans who may have disagreed on many other things, but they could always agree that there was an existential threat. It was the communist threat from the Soviet Union, and we all have to be together to stand up against that. And when that went away in the 90s, I think it slowly dried up, cracked up, and then kind of blew away some of the glue that was holding conservatives together and opened the way for somebody who wasn't so conventional to move in.
It's interesting. Yeah, you have said that Donald Trump is not really a conservative. He's a populist, a pragmatist, a nationalist, but not really a classic conservative by anyone's definition. You also write that if the president wins this fall, and even more so if he loses, the question is, how does the traditional Republican message fit moving forward after everything we have been through? How would you answer that question, Jerry Seidel?
I think that is an open question, so it's kind of hard to answer. What I find is interesting is that Republicans have broken into various camps on this question. There are the people who have embraced the Trump message entirely, and then they're kind of the never-Trumpers who have just moved in a completely different direction. And then there are people who are kind of straddling or trying to straddle a little bit, and that includes some people, many Republicans in Congress who are trying to make accommodations with, but it also includes a group of younger conservative thinkers who are trying to figure out how do you construct a new conservative message that takes into account the populist nationalist mood, the anti-globalist, conservative libertarian economics mood, with some of the classic conservative philosophies of, you know, limited central government and fiscal discipline. How do you put those things together? And that work is underway, kind of out of the public view in many ways, but it's happening in think tanks and in seminars and in conversations among young conservatives who kind of think, well, we need to move into the 21st century. Interestingly, I think George W. Bush actually realized that as well, and compassionate conservatism, which he championed, was part of that, but he didn't really get to finish the project because of 9/11.
We are discussing the rise of the Republican Party and where it is heading. My guest this hour, the Wall Street Journal's executive Washington editor, Jerry Seib. He's author of the new book, We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to the Political Revolution. You can find an excerpt of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Much more to come after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. We are taking a look at the Republican Party this hour through the eyes of Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to the Political Revolution. Jerry Seib, you write that the Republican Party has changed in many ways, but it has become more blue-collar, more rooted in rural and small-town America, more disillusioned with the party establishment, more skeptical of free markets and global trade. It is more anti-immigration now, more angry. Dig in a bit deeper into the roots of that change, those changing demographics.
Well, I think there are two roots, two big roots that led to that. One is actually as much a Democratic as a Republican phenomenon. It was a sense for cultural reasons that a lot of people in middle America, and by middle America, I mean geographically in the middle of the country, economically in the middle of the country, and culturally in the middle of the country, kind of felt over time the Democrats had moved away from them. And that had to do with cultural issues. I mentioned earlier, prayer in schools, religious rights, gay marriage, transgender rights, but also an anti-immigrant feeling, and some would say racist feelings as well. And those people moved into the Republican Party and away from the Democratic Party. But I think the second route is that once they got there, they had a different view of what government economic policy ought to be. I think they were people who, in many cases, were victimized by free trade policies that Republicans had championed. And they felt victimized by a global economy where they were a bit marginalized. And they wanted somebody to help them. And the traditional Republican conservative message basically said, well, it's the free market. Everything will work out. And it wasn't sufficient for them. And it wasn't sufficient for Donald Trump either. And in a way, that's one of the reasons this strange marriage between the Republican Party and Donald Trump came together. It didn't happen at the upper level, at the high level, at the establishment level. It happened at the grassroots level, and it's still going on.
You talk and write about how conservatism also changed with Newt Gingrich and his contract with America. How so?
Well, I think the real evolution away from Reaganism in many ways happened in the mid-1990s with Newt Gingrich, you know, when he arrived as in many ways the successor to Ronald Reagan. George H.W. Bush took Ronald Reagan's place in the White House, obviously, and in my view, was a very successful president, but never somebody who was beloved by the conservative movement, always viewed with suspicion, particularly after he went back on his "read my lips, no new taxes" pledge and agreed to a tax increase. And a lot of conservatives were kind of done with him then. And Newt Gingrich became the titular head of the conservative movement and was very successful. I think in some ways, the high point of the conservative movement post-Reagan was in 1994 with the contract with America and the Republican takeover of the House, which was a complete shock to the system here in Washington, where I live. But it also changed the tenor of the conservative movement and the Republican Party from kind of sunny Reagan optimism to kind of a darker, harsher, hard-edged view of the world and a political message like that. And then, of course, the Newt Gingrich phenomenon faded pretty fast, in part because of some of his own flaws. And then there was a period in which there wasn't anybody who was the logical successor. So I think Newt Gingrich represented both a high point and then an end to that high point fairly quickly.
Let me play that clip. Here is then Representative Newt Gingrich announcing the Republican Party's contract with America back in 1994.
This is truly, in a way that very few political events ever are, an historic event. For all those who are tired of negative attacks, smear campaigns, for all those who've asked political parties to get together and be a responsible team, for all those who've said we have to deal in a positive way with the challenges of America's future, I hope that you listened to each of our candidates as they outlined each of the 10 bills that we have committed in our contract to bring to the floor.
You mentioned, Jerry Seib, the sunny Reagan optimism that went away after that. Yeah. It was also, you write, you know, sort of the end of politicians, sort of this genteel sort of idea of Washington. You know, politicians were more in conflict with each other because of and after Newt Gingrich. You know, before it was sort of you debate on the floor and then you go out for drinks, right? But not so much after this era.
Right. And, you know, Newt Gingrich, and I actually agree with what Newt Gingrich said there, that the contract with America itself was positive. It was forward-looking. It was an agenda. And interestingly, the contract with America never even says the word Republican. It was designed to be a document that showed conservatives know how to govern, but in a bipartisan way, or at least in a nonpartisan way. It just didn't last because that really wasn't Newt Gingrich's persona. He rose to power in many ways by attacking and then toppling Jim Wright, the Democratic Speaker of the House at the time. And that was kind of always his style. And I think the style got in the way of the message over time. Plus, Bill Clinton, you have to admit, and Newt Gingrich certainly admits, did a brilliant job, a masterful job of co-opting the Contract with America message, of moving to the center, seizing enough of that center ground to look as if he wasn't a crazy, wild-eyed liberal, which meant the attacks on him didn't really stick as much, and then pulling in voters to do that, and then by 1996 winning re-election in the center, having co-opted some of the Contract with America movement. So it wasn't just Newt Gingrich failing, it was Bill Clinton being what he always was, which is a really masterful political operator.
So you write that before Ronald Reagan in the mid-20th century, New Deal liberalism created these massive social programs, Social Security, Medicare, and then came soaring inflation and unemployment and a sense that the United States wasn't quite the dominant force on the world stage that it once had been. And, of course, the Reagan Revolution was born. My question is, are there parallels? Do you see parallels today to the end of one era and the start of another with regard to Trumpism and the Republican Party?
Well, that is a really good question, and I don't know the answer. You know, this book started in some ways because I tried to figure out where did it begin? You know, where did this movement from through Reagan to Trump begin on the Republican conservative side. And I decided the year it began was 1979, that was the year in which things seemed to be falling apart. You know, you had stagflation, you had energy crisis, you had gas lines, and then you had the ultimate embarrassment, which was that the Iranian students took hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And it felt to Americans like the wheels had fallen off. Things were out of control. And that opened the way for Ronald Reagan. Fast forward to 2020, and you have a similar set of circumstances. You have a pandemic. You have an economic crisis that results. You have racial unrest. You have violence in the streets in some places. And you have a feeling, I think some Americans do, that things are out of control. We asked the question earlier this year in our polling with the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, you think things are under control or out of control? And 80% of people said, I think things are out of control. That would look and feel like what happened in 1979, and it opened the door for the incumbent president, then Jimmy Carter, now Donald Trump, to be toppled. What's different here is that Donald Trump has managed to maintain the appearance that he's the outsider and that he's not responsible for these adverse trends. And when they pile in one on top of the other, they usually hurt the incumbent. But we'll see. And as I said earlier, the ability of Donald Trump over the last week of the Republican convention to portray himself as still the outsider looking in and Joe Biden as essentially the status quo establishment candidate is remarkable for an incumbent president, but it just might work.
Jerry Seib, hold on just a moment. Let me bring another voice into the conversation. Orrin Cass joins me from Washington. He's the executive director of American Compass, a conservative think tank. Orrin, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to our conversation here. I'm curious, first up, as a conservative, as a Republican, did you hear what you were hoping for at the Republican National Convention this week?
I wasn't thrilled with what I heard. I think there was really a lost opportunity to focus on a lot of the issues Jerry was just talking about that I think actually matter most to families and households out there in the country. And they were things that Trump did speak about so uniquely in 2016. And yet, frankly, the 2020 campaign certainly still has the Trump personality, but I think it's lost a lot of the distinctive and heterodox focus on what it is we actually want government to do.
Bobby Jindal, the former Republican governor of Louisiana, wrote in the Wall Street Journal this week, quote, "Win or lose in November, the Republican Party will not return to the old orthodoxy. Populist ideas have put down deep roots," end quote. Win or lose in November, Orrin, do you see a continued push for populist policies within the Republican Party, or do you think GOP leaders and voters will revert back to traditional orthodoxy on issues like trade and immigration and foreign policy? How do you see it?
Well, I think there will definitely be a big push. I think that's exactly the fight that we're going to have. I personally don't love the term populist because, of course, in a democracy, the premise is to offer policies that are popular. It seems to me that the real fight we have is between a Republican orthodoxy that's just been very libertarian. The basic argument has been free markets are all we need and all we want, and we're just going to keep doing more of that. And what I would say is a much more genuinely conservative alternative that still, you know, values markets, but recognizes that the end goal here isn't just free markets and high stock prices. It's the actual good outcomes for the nation, for the stability and well-being of families and communities, and that's not something the markets have been delivering very well in recent years.
So on issues like free trade and globalization of the economy, do conservatives need to adjust or freshen their message, if you will, for a new time and a changing electorate, a changing demographic, as Jerry was describing?
I think they absolutely do, and I think it's important to recognize just how much things have changed. I mean, I think a lot of what Ronald Reagan said in 1980 was correct in 1980. There were a lot of important and useful reforms that he pursued, but the challenges that we have in this country today economically are very different. The way that trade works when you have China out there with an economy as large as ours, with more than a billion people and an authoritarian communist government, that's a very different formula for trade. I think when you look at how the American labor market has shifted and the challenges that particularly workers with less than a college degree are facing, that's a very different context for immigration. And so I think we need to ask, what are we going to do to get our labor markets healthy to make sure our economy is generating good jobs and opportunities for American workers? And the task for conservatives is to take conservative principles and apply them to that set of questions. And we shouldn't expect to have the same answers that Ronald Reagan had 40 years ago or that Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek had 60 years ago.
Well, to that point, there seems to be a new generation of younger conservatives trying to figure out how to take traditional conservative thoughts and principles and adjust them to the age of Trump, post-Trump. I've heard, for example, Senator Marco Rubio push for what he calls a common good capitalism. Here he is during a speech at Catholic University of America in November, sharing his message about the country's current economic system.
It's bad economically because it's leaving too many people behind. It's bad because it's inflicting tremendous damage on our families, our communities, and our society. Common good capitalism is about a vibrant and growing free market. But it is also about harnessing and channeling that growth to the benefit of our country, of our people, and our society at large.
Orrin Cass, respond to that and this notion that the Republican Party needs to sort of shift and evolve and change.
Well, I think Senator Rubio is exactly right. I think it was a really important speech he gave. I recommend giving it a read for listeners out there. And he's really been an important leader on a lot of this thinking, which, as he said, starts from this acknowledgement that we are not getting the outcomes that we want, that the, you know, free markets are an incredibly important foundation for a free society, and they're indispensable to generating prosperity. But there's nothing in economic theory that says it doesn't matter what else is going on, markets are just going to work out great for everybody. And, you know, I think it was especially interesting when Jerry was talking earlier about the transition out of the Cold War. You know, for younger conservatives that have really sort of come of political age and developed their policy thinking in a post-Cold War era, it's not just that the battle isn't against global communism. It's that the set of crises that we've encountered, you know, when you think especially about the great financial crisis and its aftermath and the slow recovery, are ones that just point to a different set of challenges. They are a case where the market did not work especially well. And especially looking over really the past 30 years, we have a period where, you know, the typical worker, the typical household, especially if you look at the millennial generation, mm-hmm. The economic outcomes have just not been very good. And so I think what Senator Rubio is saying is exactly right. And it's fundamentally a conservative insight, which is that, you know, markets are a function of the institutions that they are interacting with and the rules that govern them. And you don't just get to kind of close your eyes and jump. You actually have to be really thoughtful about those things. And there has to be a role for public policy in saying, how do we get markets and the people competing within them to actually generate the kind of outcomes and prosperity for all kinds of people and also in all places, mm-hmm. you know, not just in concentrated pockets. That's just vital if we're going to have a healthy nation.
Jerry Seib, jump back in here. I thought what Orrin said was so interesting. Republicans are not getting the outcomes that they want. You've written something to the extent of the conservative movement needs to climb down from the ivory tower of hands-off economic theory and create a more practical version of itself. So to Orrin's point and what he was saying and all of your research and watching this over 40 years, what does that look like?
Well, first of all, I think that Orrin said something really important, which is that a lot of what people, including people in my business, including me, frankly, described as conservative economic philosophy over the years is really more libertarian. economic philosophy. And I think the conservative message that Orrin and others are trying to develop is not strictly libertarian, does not want to be libertarian. It wants to be conservative in a broader sense. So that's an important point to make. And it's interesting that we're talking here about Marco Rubio, because having spent some time on the 2016 campaign trail, Marco Rubio actually tried to inject some of this conversation into the 2016 campaign, some of these ideas, some of this, like, let's update the message. But, you know, in that environment with Donald Trump, you couldn't break through. The noise was just too loud. And so you're not getting this forward-looking conversation until now in some ways.
We are looking at the Republican Party from President Ronald Reagan to Donald Trump and the way forward with Jerry Seib, author of the new book, We Should Have Seen It Coming, and Orrin Kass, executive director of American Compass, a conservative think tank. Much more to come. I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. We will be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Well, on Monday, we're talking about a way to regain normalcy during the pandemic by increasing the availability of rapid COVID-19 testing, even tests you can take at home. What questions do you have for our experts? How would at-home rapid results tests impact your behavior or your decisions? What has your experience been with COVID testing so far? We'd love to hear your story. 617-353-0683. Well, a great conversation this hour. We are talking about the Republican Party with the Wall Street Journal's Jerry Seib. His new book is We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to the Political Revolution. We're also joined by Orrin Kass, executive director of the conservative think tank American Compass. And in the context of our conversation this hour, I want to listen back to some of the speakers from this week's Republican National Convention.
Donald Trump did not come to Washington to win praise from the Beltway elites. Donald Trump came to Washington for one reason and one reason alone, to make America great again.
The hard truth is, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America.
He's a Trojan horse with Bernie, AOC, Pelosi, Black Lives Matter, and his party's entire left wing.
It's all on the line. President Trump believes in you. He emancipates and lifts you up to live your American dream.
And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it.
Let me bring into the conversation now Mindy Finn, co-founder of Stand Up Republic, a media and grassroots organization focused on accountable government, electoral reform, and inclusion. Stand Up Republic has been hosting its own convention this week called the Convention on Founding Principles. Mindy, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
So why an alternative Republican convention this week? Didn't like the one that was on TV?
No, look, Jane, I've worked or participated in the last four Republican conventions. I have been a Republican for most of my adult life, personally and professionally. But, you know, today's Republican Party is going in a direction that, you know, I think has turned off and disaffected a significant portion of Americans who once identified themselves as Republicans. So the Convention on Founding Principles was meant to be an alternative platform and home for, you know, both kind of luminaries who have feel that the party has left them, but also a new generation of Americans who don't really, you know, may otherwise have identified with the Republican Party. They don't necessarily identify as Democrats, but they want to move forward on a, you know, more hopeful platform and one that is constructive. And they're looking for a place where they can do that. And the Convention on Principles provided that platform.
So I have heard, to your point, many Republicans lament that under Donald Trump, the GOP is not a party of ideas anymore. No real organizing principles. It's more a cult of personality, identity-based populism. Do you agree with that? Is that sort of at the heart of what you're saying here?
Yeah, I mean, at the heart, you know, today's Republican Party is the Trump Party, and you're either with him, and if you're not with him, then you don't belong. It is not a party that's focused on governing. It's a party that's focused on fear, and in many cases, manufactured fear in order to gain popular support. We believe that you have to start from, you know, first core principles and values, and many of those are actually the core principles that were they're in the Constitution that have underpinned our nation since its founding. And you have to start from a place of ideas and policy generation and governing. You know, when I hear in kind of the previous conversation around aspirations to have economic policy that serves more Americans and not just the elites, when I hear some of the rhetoric from the Republican convention, there's really a disconnect from what you hear in aspiration and outcomes, because this is a party that's a lot of talk and may say these things for thematic purposes. But the outcomes are a far cry from what they aspirationally say they stand for and what they're going to do.
But certainly there have been bold and bright ideas proposed by Republican leaders. I mean, people like Paul Ryan, you know, talked about term limits and a balanced budget amendment and reforms to Social Security and Medicare, anti-poverty programs. I mean, these big ideas that seemed, you know, interesting. But what happened? Why didn't voters latch on? Why didn't the Republican electorate and others take the bait?
Yeah, I mean, your Paul Ryan certainly did. And Paul Ryan kind of got chased away, you know, from the party and right. The way people like Mitt Romney are being cast out from the mainstream of the Republican Party today. I think that's very much the point. I mean, the Republican Party is now captivated by a base that seems to be more compelled by kind of these emotions and these themes than it does by these policy ideas. That said, we have, you know, the vast majority of Americans kind of fit within this, what we call kind of the disaffected majority or exhausted majority, that feels that nobody in Washington or kind of the main leaders in Washington aren't representing them. They're not working on their behalf. And I think it's telling that, you know, every year more Americans identify as independents. They're not identifying themselves with these parties. Since Donald Trump's election, you have at least 4% to 4 to 5% of Republicans who have identified either as independent or Democrat. That may sound like a small percentage, but that represents millions of voters in the country who are civic. They care. Their political activism, their voice matters, and they don't really have a place to realize that. And so Stand Up Republic, our organization, as well as the Convention on Founding Principles, is meant to provide them that place, because we don't want to lose sight of, you know, these ideas or the ability to have influence in getting some of them enacted.
So as a younger voice, as a new generation Republican, what values do you want the Republican Party to carry into the future?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party has to be grounded in truth and evidence. You know, there is certainly space, or there should be space, to debate solutions to modern challenges. But take something like, I mean, even the national debt and the deficit. I mean, the facts are that it is getting worse. It's gotten worse under Donald Trump, more so than any president before. That's something that has to be addressed, because it's a major threat to the stability of our nation. Climate change, you know, this is something that has, unfortunately, climate denialism has come to be a mainstream position in the Republican Party. It wasn't always that way. And meanwhile, this is a problem that is getting worse. We can debate solutions, but, you know, we shouldn't deny truth and evidence. That applies to anything, you know, healthcare, the pandemic and coronavirus, you know, which we're experiencing right now. crime, you know, immigration, anything, you name it. So truth and evidence, you know, I think this free market should not sort of lose its commitment to the free market, you know, but also not kind of fall back necessarily on Reagan economics. These ideas do need to be updated for a modern time and, mm-hmm. and the way the labor market operates today. These are some of the ideas. I mean, I also think that we just can't lose sight of values and character. Those are too important to compromise. You know, integrity and decency and the way we conduct ourselves in our politics. Conservatism is not just a policy agenda. Conservatism is a way of being. It's a way of acting. I don't think conservatives own, and by any means, decency. I think rather the point is that these are values that both parties should hold. They shouldn't really be confined to party. Yeah. They should just be accepted across the board.
I think a lot of people would agree with you on that. Mindy Finn, co-founder of Stand Up Republic. I appreciate your time and thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Jerry Seib, jump back in here. Something Mindy said, well, many things, caught my attention. If you're not with Donald Trump, you don't belong. What did you hear in Mindy's message there?
Well, you know, one of the things that one of the interesting and important points that she made is also one that Orrin Cass made a while ago. And it struck me last night listening to all 70 minutes of Donald Trump's acceptance speech, which is that there wasn't much forward looking vision of the future in it. There was very little discussion of what would happen in a second Trump term. And that's kind of in keeping with the broader reality about Trumpism, which is that it doesn't really reflect a governing philosophy. It's kind of more a set of instincts. And that's a bit of a problem, because you should be creating a constituency and a campaign, I think, for what you're going to do, so that there is a kind of a foothold in the body politic for taking tough actions after you win a re-election campaign. And that's kind of not there. But it also creates the opening for the kind of conversation, you know, that we're having here, and that for what Warren and others are doing, which is trying to create a philosophy around some of these ideas. I also agree when Warren said that populism is probably not the best term for what we're talking about here. It's not exactly that. And somebody's going to need to come up with a better one, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Orrin Cass, as I listened to Mindy, you know, I was thinking how the Republican Party long preached the economic virtues of immigration, for example, of fiscal conservatism. That is so far from what we're hearing and seeing now in this Republican Party. What happened to that message?
Well, I think you're right that there's certainly a lack of that in the message at the moment. You know, part of what happened to it is that it doesn't actually address the problems that we have. I mean, I really admire a lot of the work that Mindy's doing, but I was frankly frustrated to listen to her kind of describe the things that she would have at the top of her agenda as things like deficit reduction and climate change. I think a comprehensive conservative agenda certainly needs to have thoughtful approaches to those things, but you didn't hear anything in there about what we're actually going to do about this economy. How are we going to have an economy that works for the typical American household? And how are we going to make markets work? Because if conservatives can't find a way to make markets work for the typical American, then Americans are going to turn to the party that doesn't seem so interested in making markets work. And so in my mind, that really has to be front and center. And that somewhat hopefully answers your question of, well, what happened to some of those topics is that I think voters are and then as a consequence, politicians are rightly saying, well, that's not going to get the job done right now.
Jerry Seib, we're living in such a volatile time with extraordinary political dysfunction. You have extremes on the left, extremes on the right. Nobody seems to be talking to each other. The president of the United States and the Speaker of the House literally cannot stand to be in the same room together. It seems to be getting worse, not better. And I don't see a change. I mean, how does the Republican Party, setting aside the Democrats, how does the Republican Party change that? And to Mindy's point, you know, the policies of the party and the agenda is a way of being. It's a way of acting. I mean, how do you shift that back?
You know, I think that is the problem writ large right now in the city of Washington, where I'm sitting. And I'm not sure I know exactly how you fix that, except that I think you try to recognize, and this is eminently doable whether Donald Trump wins or not over the next 4 years, on some areas where there's actually an agreement that something ought to be done. I'll cite three things. There is the makings out there for an immigration reform package. I mean, that can be done. There's actually room for some action on climate change in both parties. And there's actually room for something that Orrin talks about a lot, which is a kind of an industrial policy, something that uses the power of government to help, in particular, manufacturing companies, manufacturing sectors in this economy. If you strip away the rhetoric, everybody kind of thinks, not everybody, but there's a big broad area in the middle where people think that's a good idea because the global economy has changed so much and manufacturing is so important to our communities that you hear both Donald Trump and Joe Biden talking about it. Well, then let's get together and maybe think about what to do about it.
So about a couple minutes left here. I'd like to ask both of you to think about and express to us, win or lose, what the Republican Party looks like post-Donald Trump. Orrin Cass, you first. What do you see?
Well, I think we'll have a fight for either a pre-Trump party that pretends this never happened and sounds like what 2016 might have been if he'd never come down the escalator. And against that, and what I hope prevails is what I'll call a post-Trump party, which learns a few lessons from him directly, but more so learns from the reality of the conditions that allowed him to be successful. And I think, like Jerry said, focuses on this question of actual government policy that's going to help get the economy on track, support industries like manufacturing, does a lot of work on education, focusing not on getting everyone through college, but actually non-college pathways for the majority of Americans who don't earn a degree, and maybe even thinks about something new like organized labor. You know, we're doing a big project now on what could a conservative future for the labor movement look like, because the system we have now obviously is quite dysfunctional, but as with a lot of things, the idea of labor and workers having organizations that support them and that give them power, that should be a conservative idea. That should be the kind of thing that we're moving forward and using to shape an economy in which markets can really work.
Jerry Seib, you get the last word. Win or lose, what does the Republican Party look like post-Trump?
Well, I think it's not win or lose. That is the question. If Donald Trump wins, there's one answer to that question. If he loses, there's another answer to that question. So I think in many ways, the extent to which Trumpism becomes Republicanism is one of the things that will be determined on November 3rd. In four more years, and I think a lot of Republicans who both like Donald Trump and don't like Donald Trump would agree on this, in four more years, there'll be a lot less of the old kind of Reagan view of the world left. In the event in which Donald Trump loses, there will be a very big debate within the Republican Party about whether to snap back to something different, to move on to a kind of new age conservatism of the kind that Orrin talks about, or whether there's just going to be a fight because Donald Trump isn't entirely going to go away.
Fascinating. I really appreciate both of you coming on today. Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution. Jerry, thank you very much for your work and your time today.
My pleasure.
Orrin Cass, executive director of American Compass. I appreciate your perspective and your input today. Orrin, thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast, and our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.